Section 2. Concerning the determination of the will. By determining the will, if the phrase be used with any meaning, must be intended, causing that the act of the will or choice should be thus, and not otherwise in the will is said to be determined, when, in consequence of some action, or influence, its choice is directed to, and fixed upon a particular object. As when we speak of the determination of motion, we mean causing the motion of the body to be in such a direction, rather than another. The determination of the will supposes an effect, which must have a cause. If the will be determined, there is a determiner. This must be supposed to be intended even by them that say, the will determines itself. If it be so, the will is both determiner and determined. It is a cause that acts and produces effects upon itself, and is the object of its own influence and action. With respect to that grand inquiry, what determines the will? It would be very tedious and unnecessary, at present, to examine all the various opinions which have been advanced concerning this matter. Nor is it needful that I should enter into a particular discussion of all points debated in disputes on that other question, whether the will always follows the last dictate of the understanding. It is sufficient to my present purpose to say, it is that motive, which, as it stands in view of the mind, is the strongest, that determines the will. But may be necessary that I should a little explain my meaning. By motive I mean the whole of that which moves, excites, or invites the mind to volition, whether that be one thing singly, or many things conjunctly. Many particular things may concur, and unite their strength, to induce the mind. And when it is so, all together are as one complex motive. And when I speak of the strongest motive, I have respect to the strength of the whole that operates to induce a particular act of volition, whether that be the strength of one thing alone, or of many together. Whatever is objectively 107 a motive, in this sense, must be something that is extant in the view or apprehension of the understanding, or perceiving faculty. Nothing can induce or invite the mind to will or act anything, any further than it is perceived, or is some way or other in the mind's view. For what is wholly unperceived and perfectly out of the mind's view, cannot affect the mind at all. It is most evident, that nothing is in the mind, or reaches it, or takes any hold of it, any otherwise than as it is perceived or thought of. And I think it must also be allowed by all, that everything that is properly called a motive, excitement, or inducement to a perceiving, willing agent, has some sort and degree of tendency, or advantage to move or excite the will, previous to the effect, or to the act of the will excited. This previous tendency of the motive is what I call the strength of the motive. That motive which has a less degree of previous advantage, or tendency to move the will, or which appears less inviting, as it stands in the view of the mind, is what I call a weaker motive. On the contrary, that which appears most inviting, and has, by what appears concerning it to the understanding or apprehension, the greatest degree of previous tendency to excite and induce the choice, is what I call the strongest motive. And in this sense, I suppose the will is always determined by the strongest motive. Things that exist in the view of the mind have their strength, tendency, or advantage to move, or excite its will, from many things appertaining to the nature and circumstances of the thing viewed, the nature and circumstances of the mind that views, and the degree and manner of its view, of which it would perhaps be hard to make a perfect enumeration. But so much I think may be determined in general, without room for controversy, that whatever is perceived or apprehended by an intelligent and voluntary agent, which has the nature and influence of a motive to volition or choice, is considered or viewed as good. Nor has it any tendency to engage the election of the soul in any further degree than it appears such. For to say otherwise, would be to say, that things that appear, have a tendency, by the appearance they make, to engage the mind to elect them, some other way than by their appearing eligible to it. Which is absurd. And therefore it must be true, in some sense, that the will always is, as the greatest apparent good is. But only, for the right understanding of this, two things must be well and distinctly observed. 1. It must be observed in what sense I use the term good. Namely, as of the same import with agreeable. To appear good to the mind, as I use the phrase, is the same as to appear agreeable, or seem pleasing to the mind. Certainly, Nothing appears inviting and eligible to the mind, or tending to engage its inclination and choice, considered as evil or disagreeable. Nor indeed, as indifferent, and neither agreeable nor disagreeable. But if it tends to draw the inclination, and move the will, it must be under the notion of that which suits the mind. And therefore that must have the greatest tendency to attract and engage it, which as it stands in the mind's view, suits it best, and pleases it most. And in that sense, is the greatest apparent good to say otherwise, is little, if anything, short of a direct and plain contradiction. The word good, in this sense, includes in its signification, the removal or avoiding of evil, or of that which is disagreeable and uneasy. It is agreeable and pleasing, to avoid what is disagreeable and displeasing, and to have uneasiness removed. So that here is included what Mr. Locke supposes determines the will. For when he speaks of uneasiness, as determining the will, he must be understood as supposing that the end or aim which governs in the volition or act of preference, is the avoiding or the removal of that uneasiness. And that is the same thing as choosing and seeking what is more easy and agreeable. 2. When I say, that the will is as the greatest apparent good, or, as I have explained it, that volition has always for its object the thing which appears most agreeable, it must be carefully observed, to avoid confusion and needless objection, that I speak of the direct and immediate object of the act of volition, and not some object to which the act of will has only an indirect and remote respect. Many acts of volition have some remote relation to an object that is different from the thing most immediately willed and chosen. Thus, when a drunkard has his liquor before him, and he has to choose whether to drink it or no, the immediate objects, about which his present volition is conversant, and between which his choice now decides, are his own acts, in drinking the liquor, or letting it alone. And this will certainly be done according to what, in the present view of his mind, taken in the whole of it, is most agreeable to him. If he chooses to drink it, and not to let it alone, then this action, as it stands in the view of his mind, with all that belongs to its appearance there, is more agreeable and pleasing than letting it alone. But the objects to which this act of volition may relate more remotely, and between which his choice may determine more indirectly, are the present pleasure the man expects by drinking, and the future misery which he judges will be the consequence of it. He may judge that this future misery, when it comes, will be more disagreeable and unpleasant than refraining from drinking now would be. But these two things are not the proper objects that the act of volition spoken of is next conversant about. For the act of will spoken of is concerning present drinking, or forbearing to drink. If he wills to drink, then drinking is the proper object of the act of his will. And drinking, on some account or other, now appears most agreeable to him, and suits him best. If he chooses to refrain, then refraining is immediate object of his will, and is most pleasing to him. If in the choice he makes in the case, he prefers a present pleasure to a future advantage, which he judges will be greater when it comes, then a lesser present pleasure appears more agreeable to him than a greater advantage at a distance. If on the contrary a future advantage is preferred, then that appears most agreeable, and suits him best. And so still, the present volition is, as the greatest apparent good at present is. I have rather chosen to express myself thus, that the will always is as the greatest apparent good, or as what appears most agreeable, than to say that the will is determined by the greatest apparent good, or by what seems most agreeable. Because an appearing most agreeable to the mind, and the mind's preferring, seems scarcely distinct. If strict propriety of speech be insisted on, it may more properly be said, that the voluntary action, which is the immediate consequence of the mind's choice, is determined by that which appears most agreeable, than the choice itself. But that volition itself is always determined by that in or about the mind's view of the object, which causes it to appear most agreeable. I say, in or about the mind's view of the object. Because what has influence to render an object in view agreeable, is not only what appears in the object viewed, but also the manner of the view and the state and circumstances of the mind that views. Particularly to enumerate all things pertaining to the mind's view of the objects of volition, which have influence in their appearing agreeable to the mind, would be a matter of no small difficulty, and might require a treatise by itself, and is not necessary to my present purpose. I shall therefore only mention some things in general. One thing that makes an object proposed to choice agreeable is the apparent nature and circumstances of the object, and there are various things of this sort that have influence in rendering the object more or less agreeable. As 1. That which appears in the object, rendering it beautiful and pleasant, or deformed and irksome to the mind, viewing it is in itself. 2. The apparent degree of pleasure or trouble attending the object, or the consequence of it. Such concomitants and consequences being viewed as circumstances of the object, are to be considered as belonging to it, and as it were parts of it, as it stands in the mind's view of proposed object of choice. 3. The apparent state of the pleasure or trouble that appears, with respect to distance of time, being either near or farther off. It is a thing in itself agreeable to the mind to have pleasure speedily, and disagreeable to have it delayed, so that if there be two equal degrees of pleasure set in the mind's view, and all other things are equal, but one is beheld as near, and the other afar off, the nearer will appear most agreeable, and so will be chosen. Because, though the agreeableness of the objects be exactly equal, as viewed in themselves, yet not as viewed in their circumstances, one of them having the additional agreeableness of the circumstance of nearness. 2. Another thing that contributes to the agreeableness of an object of choice, as it stands in the mind's view, is the manner of view. If the object be something which appears connected with future pleasure, not only will the degree of apparent pleasure have influence, but also the manner of the view, especially in two respects. 1. With respect to the degree of assent with which the mind judges the pleasure to be future, because it is more agreeable to have a certain happiness than an uncertain one, and a pleasure viewed as more probable, all other things being equal, is more agreeable to the mind than that which is viewed as less probable. 2. With respect to the degree of the idea or apprehension of the future pleasure, with regard to things which are the subject of our thoughts, either past, present, or future, we have much more of an idea or apprehension of some things than others. That is, our idea is much more clear, lively, and strong. Thus the ideas we have of sensible things by immediate sensation are usually much more lively than those we have by mere imagination or by contemplation of them when absent. My idea of the sun when I look upon it is more vivid than when I only think of it. Our idea of the sweet relish of a delicious fruit is usually stronger when we taste it than when we only imagine it. And sometimes, the idea we have of things by contemplation are much stronger and clearer than at other times. Thus, a man at one time has a much stronger idea of the pleasure which is to be enjoyed in eating some sort of food that he loves than at another. Now the strength of the idea or the sense that men have of future good or evil is one thing that has great influence on their minds to excite volition. When two kinds of future pleasure are presented for choice, though both are supposed exactly equal by the judgment, and both equally certain, yet of one the mind has a far more lively sense than of the other. This last has the greatest advantage by far to affect and attract the mind and move the will. It is now more agreeable to the mind to take the pleasure of which it has a strong and lively sense than that of which it has only a faint idea. The view of the former is attended with the strongest appetite, and the greatest uneasiness attends the want of it. And it is agreeable to the mind to have uneasiness removed, and its appetite gratified. And if several future enjoyments are presented together, as competitors for the choice of the mind, some of them judged to be greater, and others less. The mind also having a more lively idea of the good of some, and of others a less. And some are viewed as of greater certainty or probability than others. And those enjoyments that appear most agreeable in one of these respects, appear least so in others. In this case, all other things being equal, the agreeableness of a proposed object of choice will be in a degree some way compounded of the degree of good supposed by the judgment, the degree of apparent probability or certainty of that good, and the degree of the liveliness of the idea the mind has of that good. Because all together concur to constitute the degree in which the object appears at present agreeable, and accordingly will volition be determined. I might further observe that the state of the mind which views a proposed object of choice is another thing that contributes to the agreeableness or disagreeableness of that object. The particular temper which the mind has by nature, or that has been introduced and established by education, example, custom, or some other means. Or the frame or state that the mind is in on a particular occasion, that object which appears agreeable to one, does not so to another. And the same object does not always appear alike agreeable to the same person, at different times. It is most agreeable to some men, to follow their reason. And to others, to follow their appetites. To some men, it is more agreeable to deny a vicious inclination, than to gratify it. Others it suits best to gratify the vilest appetites. It is more disagreeable to some men than others, to counteract a former resolution. In these respects, and many others which might be mentioned, different things will be most agreeable to different persons. And not only so, but to the same persons at different times. But possibly it is needless to mention the state of the mind, as a ground of the agreeableness of objects distinct from the other two mentioned before. Namely, the apparent nature and circumstances of the objects viewed, and the manner of the view. Perhaps, if we strictly consider the matter, the different temper and state of the mind makes no alteration as to the agreeableness of objects, any other way, than as it makes the objects themselves appear differently beautiful or deformed, having apparent pleasure or pain attending them. And, as it occasions the manner of the view to be different, causes the idea of beauty or deformity, pleasure or uneasiness, to be more or less lively. However, I think so much is certain, that volition, in no one instance that can be mentioned, is otherwise than the greatest apparent good is, in the manner which has been explained. The choice of the mind never departs from that which, at the time, and with respect to the direct and immediate objects of decision, appears most agreeable and pleasing, all things considered. If the immediate objects of the will are a man's own actions, then those actions which appear most agreeable to him he wills. If it be now most agreeable to him, all things considered, to walk, then he now wills to walk. If it be now, upon the whole of what at present appears to him, most agreeable to speak, then he chooses to speak. If it suits him best to keep silence, then he chooses to keep silence. There is scarcely a plainer and more universal dictate of the sense and experience of mankind, than that, when men act voluntarily, and do what they please, then they do what suits them best, or what is most agreeable to them. To say, that they do what pleases them, but yet not what is agreeable to them, is the same thing as to say, they do what they please, but do not act their pleasure. And that is to say, that they do what they please and yet do not what they please. It appears from these things, that in some sense, the will always follows the last dictate of the understanding. But then the understanding must be taken in a large sense, as including the whole faculty of perception or apprehension, and not merely what is called reason or judgment. If by the dictate of the understanding is meant what reason declares to be best, or most for the person's happiness, taking in the whole of its duration, it is not true that the will always follows the last dictate of the understanding. Such a dictate of reason is quite a different matter from things appearing now most agreeable, all things being put together which pertain to the mind's present perceptions in any respect, although that dictate of reason, when it takes place, has concerning the compound influence which moves the will, and should be considered in estimating the degree of that appearance of good which the will always follows, either as having its influence added to other things, or subducted from them. When such dictate of reason concurs with other things, then its weight is added to them, as put into the same scale. But when it is against them, it is as a weight in the opposite scale, resisting the influence of other things, yet its resistance is often overcome by their greater weight, and so the act of the will is determined in opposition to it. These things may serve, I hope, in some measure, illustrate and confirm the position laid down in the beginning of section, namely, that the will is always determined by the strongest motive, or by that view of the mind which has the greatest degree of previous tendency to excite volition. But whether I have been so happy as rightly to explain the thing wherein consists the strength of motives, or not, yet my failing in this will not overthrow the position itself, which carries much of its own evidence with it, and is a point of chief importance to the purpose of the ensuing discourse, and the truth of it, I hope, will appear with great clearness, Before I have finished what I have to say on the subject of human liberty,